I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, guess what, folks? We are moles in the ground. As for me, I'm proud of it. After all, us moles, we've made history. What's good about this country? The Bill of Rights, the rule of law, freedom of speech and assembly, that is, to the extent that we have them. Still more than in most countries. Also public schools, the newly won commitments to racial and gender equality. And environmental restoration. These are, of course, limited commitments, to be sure. All these are the results of struggles from below, struggles by your fellow moles and all those who preceded us. Power never concedes unless it's forced to, and privilege continually tries to reestablish itself. But working people and subordinated groups in this country, they've also been tenacious. So to sum up the mole record, well, we've won a lot. There's lots to celebrate, and of course, much to do. This is still a very hierarchical top-down country and getting more unequal, certainly with respect to wealth. But still, it has a very feisty and unruly people. Today on the Old Mole, that's the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 Radio, Portland, Oregon, independent listener-supported. Also supported by our underwriters, Cotton Cloud Futon. More about them later. Today on the Mole, I'll be interviewing Tyson Slocum of the Public Citizen Energy Project on the spike in gasoline prices in the U.S. energy future. Also today, the new drug benefit program by today's well-read red, Clayton Morgridge. Our movie roles today's Denise Morris and Angela Jones saw the teen frenzy film Stick It, and they'll tell you about it. And we end the show talking with Ashley Albies, a local lawyer challenging the Bush administration's illegal wiretap and other grave illegalities, all, of course, to defend our national security. That's all on today's Old Mole. First, Tyson Slocum, welcome to KBOO.
Glad to be here.
Tyson Slocum is director of the Public Citizens Energy Program. Tyson Slocum, let's talk about the spike in gas prices. Why are the companies making so much money?
Well, because when the price of oil goes up, the profits of oil companies go up. Remember, some of these oil companies, especially one like ExxonMobil, is one of the world's largest oil producers. So any oil producer, whether it's Saudi Arabia or ExxonMobil, get rich whenever the price of oil goes up. On average, it costs and a company like ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil, whether that's in Nigeria or Alaska. But they're turning around and selling it to us for $70. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're clearing about a $50 windfall profit on every barrel of oil
right.
that they sell.
Let's go through the details of it. My sense is these companies are all sort of integrated, right? They both produce oil, they get it out of the ground, and then they sell it to the refineries, often their own refineries, for the world market price. That's the difference between the 20 and the 70?
The profits on the crude oil is one thing. They're also making additional profits on the fact that they own oil refineries where they're turning that crude oil into refined products like gasoline and jet fuel and other things. So they're making huge profits at every stage of production. So we're paying much higher amounts for our gasoline, and it isn't being reinvested into, you know, the higher prices aren't being used to reinvest into renewable energy or energy efficiency
right.
or mass transit. It's just going to bigger corporate profits.
Right. So they're doing it on both sides. They're charging,
That's right.
They're charging the refinery companies a lot more, and then the refinery companies themselves are charging a lot more than.
That's right. And in some cases, the oil producers own the refineries.
I mean,
you know, the biggest owners of refineries in North America are the big oil producers, Exxon and BP and Shell and all those guys.
And none of the costs of producing the oil have gone up at all. The refineries still run at their super rate with very few employees. Every now and then blow up, though, because they hiring out contract labor, so they blow up more, and the cost of pumping the oil out of the ground hasn't gone up at all, maybe a penny or two a barrel, I suppose, if electricity gets it more expensive. But they boosted prices on all levels. Part of that, though, is speculative, isn't it? I mean, there are these futures markets.
Yeah, I mean, contrary to popular opinion, the price of oil is not set by Saudi Arabia or any other OPEC member nation. It's set by energy traders on Wall Street.
Right.
And those energy traders are increasingly hedge funds, investment banks, and other financial firms. And most of their activities are totally unregulated. It's like we haven't even learned the lesson from Enron. We are deregulating these energy markets, ceding more authority to these private companies without any protections for consumers. And that's the big problem here, is that consumers are paying a lot more for our energy. But unlike in Europe, where they pay much more than we do, but they pay more in the form of taxes, which are used to subsidize their mass transit systems and renewable energy development and energy efficiency, that's not happening here in the United States. Instead, the higher prices that Americans are paying are just going into bigger corporate profits, and that's not going to do anything to address the long-term energy needs, which is why Public Citizen supports a windfall profits tax on these record earnings by oil companies and dedicating the revenues of that tax to actually solving America's energy crisis.
Right. Let's talk about that. Let's just summarize where all that money is going then, and then we'll get into the excess profits tax. So part of it's going to these production companies, and some of it, of course, the production companies are owned by Russia, Venezuela, and other, where they've nationalized, or where they get a higher percent of the amount of money that the companies that are actually there. So it's going. That's one of them. The other one is the refining companies, right? They've also boosted all of their prices way above, much further above their cost of production. And then it's going to the hedge funds, right, and all the financiers who buy futures or, you know, trade in all these various infinite number of financial instruments on oil.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got a narrow group of oil companies and hedge funds that are getting extremely rich off of high energy prices, and you've got a lot of suffering by American families. And now there are some out there who think, well, you know, America has paid too little for energy, especially gasoline, and if we want to address our environmental problems, we have to force conservation in this country by pricing energy at punitively high levels, where Americans will be forced to conserve. And that's true to a certain extent, but I don't want to see high energy prices come at the expense of livability standards for America's working
families. Yeah, well, you could say the same thing about food or heating oil or, in fact, water, right? If we only didn't subsidize them a little bit and allow them to sell at market prices, then it would be a little more rational. Of course, what you would be doing is starving the lower half of the population.
Exactly. At a time when under the Bush economy already moderate and low-income people are losing ground every day, families are struggling just to get by. When you start increasing dramatically energy costs, that's taking a real hit to American working families.
Yeah, and means they can't travel. Like, since we've set up a system where public transit is so meager and so inconvenient, people have to use their cars. It's like food, right? There's not a, it's not so flexible.
Absolutely. I don't want to see extremely higher prices charged to consumers until we start laying the groundwork for some alternatives so that you're not punishing everybody, especially the poor, without giving them an alternative. I'm lucky enough to live in a city like Washington, D.C., that has a fantastic mass transit system. I can take the subway to work. I can take it to the airport. I can take it shopping. It is an extensive network. It costs billions of dollars to implement it, but it is paid off with more and more people able to get out of their cars and onto mass transit.
Oh, so the people who run the country and who spend a good deal of time in Washington, D.C., particularly the elected people, recognize that mass transit can keep a city livable. That is, it means there's a lot less congestion and people can move around. But that insight has not been transferred to the rest of the country.
Well, no, and a lot of it is because of politics. I mean, you had President Bush sign into law the most expensive energy bill in our nation's history this past August. And that bill spends $0 on mass transit systems. It did, however, manage to find $5 billion in new subsidies to oil companies. Mm-hmm. So that's been the priority of the Bush administration and this congressional leadership, is to continue to subsidize dirty fossil fuels and profitable oil companies, and to remove or to not invest in renewable energy or mass transit or energy efficiency, all the things that are actually going to solve America's energy problems.
Yeah, let's talk about that. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Tyson Slocum, who is the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. You can learn more about them by
short or long-term solution. It is incredibly expensive. The energy bill that the president signed into law this August provides $13 billion in new subsidies to the nuclear power industry. That's on top of record levels of subsidies that the industry is already getting. So financially, nuclear power can't stand on its own two feet. It contains high-level radioactive waste for which there is no safe solution. That is not the answer for America's energy problems.
What about the biomass stuff and the use of corn to produce ethanol and hydrogen and all the rest of that? That is farm crops, agriculture as the answer.
Well, yes and no. There are still problems with ethanol. It isn't truly a renewable source, and especially corn-based ethanol takes a heck of a lot more energy to produce that ethanol than is actually delivered in the form of the ethanol fuel. Ethanol refineries are very polluting. It takes enormous amounts of resources to grow these crops for fuels, especially water, coming at in areas of the United States where access to water resources is a major environmental problem. So long term, substantially increasing production of ethanol from crops is not going to be sustainable. It's not going to be the solution that we need.
And soil degradation, it seems to me, which is getting worse and worse. Soil and
absolutely.
Water.
Yeah. And actually, when you've got millions of people in the world that are starving,
right?
They don't have adequate access to food. The fact that people are proposing using precious cropland space for America's energy appetite rather than trying to get that food to people to eat, that is also another issue.
The amount of wheat barely enough to feed people, even if you divided it equally and didn't feed it the cows. Taking more of it than for gasoline, basically, it seems to me is a crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
What should be done?
Well, like I was saying, we need a windfall profits tax. We outline all of this on our website at www.citizen.org. Where the tax would be a new kind of income tax on very wealthy oil companies, and the proceeds of that tax should be dedicated to funding bigger investments in mass transit and alternative fuels, in hydrogen, energy efficiency, and renewable energy. We also need to improve fuel economy standards.
Right. And solar energy and wind, it seems to me, and wave energy, there are clearly, though, you're going to have to also use less energy less energy into private automobiles, although far more efficient private automobiles.
Yeah, absolutely.
One last thing, Tyson Slocum, who's the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. When we're talking about technologies, often the conversation stops with which technology is most efficient and least dangerous and least polluting. It seems to me we also, there's one other criteria that gets lost, and that's the criteria of sort of democracy. Some technologies really lend themselves to being implemented in a democratic way where communities have a role in it, where the work is good, and where the technology is simple enough so ordinary people can and small communities can actually implement it. And some technologies are, in fact, absolutely centralized, militarized, like nuclear, and run by national engineers and sort of military experts, too, and police experts, because these places are so dangerous. How do we think about the question of a democratic integration of these new technologies? Which of them lend themselves best to real community?
Well, I think development of hydrogen is definitely the most promising. You know, the big problem has been how to create hydrogen efficiently. The Bush administration is emphasizing using natural gas and nuclear power to create hydrogen, and that's just not going to cut it. We need green hydrogen, hydrogen that is created from renewable energy, so we have zero pollution going into creating hydrogen and zero pollution coming out of using hydrogen. And hydrogen fuel cells, where hydrogen is used as a fuel to generate electricity for a motor that would drive automobiles and for generating electric power, that is definitely the future. And investing in these types of clean energy resources is what the government should be doing, and not subsidizing oil companies, which is the way the current government funding program is under the president.
Tyson Slocum, thanks a lot for talking to us again. Tyson Slocum's head of Public Citizen's Energy Program, and if you just Google Public Citizen, you'll get into their studies and reports. Thanks a lot.
It was my pleasure.
Right. So long. And that was Tyson Slocum. This is KBOO Radio, your Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay tuned for number of pieces, including Bush administration illegality and the emerging police and surveillance state, including the electronic transmission scandal now happening, the recording of everything you do. Also, our movie moles are reviewing Stick It, and our well-read Red is going to examine right now the new prescription drug benefit that's, I think today was the last day for enrollment for it.
Good morning, comrades. I'm Clayton Morgridge with some comments about public health and private profits. Well, today is the last day for people eligible for Medicare to sign up for the new prescription drug coverage, Medicare Part D. This plan offers seniors and people with disabilities some help in paying for prescription drugs. But this coverage is not provided to you directly by the government, as is the case with the rest of the Medicare program. When Medicare covers a doctor's visit, the doctor bills Medicare, and Medicare pays the bill, minus your deductible. When you sign up for this new prescription plan, you sign up with an insurance company, or an HMO. The pharmacy bills the insurance company, or the HMO, which is in turn reimbursed by Medicare. This means that when you sign up for the plan in the first place, you have to choose among a variety of deals offered to you by different insurance companies, and your choice will affect your monthly premium and which drugs will be covered. According to Jacob Weisberg, writing in Slate magazine on January 18th, there are more than 40 choices available in most locales, including multiple options from competing insurers, each covering different brand name drugs and offering different inducements. The only way to navigate the decision-making process is via the Internet, which some elderly people still have not learned how to use. This bewildering complexity has kept millions of senior citizens from signing up by today's deadline. Most of this complexity is the result of turning the management of the plan over to folks whose main interest is maximizing their profits rather than serving our health needs, namely insurance companies, profit-making HMOs, and the pharmaceutical companies. As a result, this plan is enormously more expensive and less efficient than it would be if it were run directly by the government, like Social Security and Medicare. This is for two reasons, according to Dean Baker, writing on the website for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. One is that if Medicare were allowed to negotiate directly with the drug industry, or to allow a single agent to negotiate on its behalf, it could purchase drugs at prices that are lower than the private insurers will pay. The other reason is that a single provider of prescription drug insurance would save tens of billions of dollars in administrative fees that result from having private insurers with marketing costs and profits. And, of course, as Baker goes on to say, a single provider could also allow for a much simpler benefit, since beneficiaries would not be forced to wade through details of various prescription drug plans in order to determine the best one. The Republican drug plan, which was passed with the help of quite a few Democrats, including our own Senator Ron Wyden, is a huge money-making opportunity for the already highly profitable pharmaceutical industry. There is, of course, another long-standing way in which our government helps the drug companies take our money, and that is through patent regulation, which gives the maker of a new drug a monopoly over it, and thus the ability to set prices without fear of competition. Dean Baker points out in a blog on beatthepress.org that drug patents raise prices by 200% or more. Not only that, the whole system of treating medicines as the intellectual private property of corporations creates an incentive for corruption. Baker argues that the predictable result of the government-granted monopoly known as a drug patent is that drug firms will lie about their test results, conceal evidence of harmful effects, use illicit political influence to get drugs approved by the FDA and purchased by government agencies like Medicaid. They'll make profits to payoffs to doctors for prescribing their drugs, make payoffs to generic manufacturers to prevent competition, and so on. When a patent expires, several manufacturers start by offering much cheaper generic brands, apparently a benefit of free market competition. But this effect is short-lived, according to a New York Times article appearing on CommonDreams.org. Prices do drop sharply when a patent expires, and a lot of companies start competing with generic versions. But before long, the competition dries out all but a few of them, and then the manufacturers often raise prices as high as the market will bear. Now, the people affected by these medical profiteerings are not just American Medicare recipients, but people all over the world with HIV and AIDS, and people in Africa and Asia with tropical diseases like malaria. An article in April in the International Herald Tribune discusses how Washington is pushing bilateral and regional trade agreements in which countries enact super patents that prolong U.S. drug makers' monopolies and limit the conditions under which patents can be broken. Because of these agreements, India's generics industry, the world's largest, is reining in plans to supply poor countries and refocusing on richer ones. Public health officials warn of catastrophic consequences if the bilateral deals are applied to AIDS drugs. If you prevent countries from using generic drugs, according to the head of Brazil's National AIDS Program, you are creating a concrete obstacle to providing access to drugs. You are promoting genocide because you're killing people. End of quote. Now, no doubt what the U.S. government means to promote is private enterprise. The genocide is merely a side effect. Well, at some point, we have to ask why our government encourages corporations, which are private organizations dedicated to getting rich, to exploit the life and death needs of the world's people. Now, this question has legs, though you'd never know it from our media and politics. Do a Google search on single-payer health care, and you'll see that lots of folks are already thinking outside this box of our broken health care system. I'm Clayton Morgridge with the well-read Red.
Thanks, Clayton Morgeridge. Next on the Mole, our movie moles. But before that, we'd like to thank our underwriters. Tammy, take it away.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Well, that wasn't Tammy, was it? I miss Tammy. She's there. At the end of the show, we'll hear your wonderful voice. Now to our next segment of the Old Mole on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Our movie moles, Denise Morris and Angela Jones, saw the teen frenzy film Stick It.
Smells like teen spirit? Well, yes, it does. Stick It, the new teenage girl flick, is full of teen spirit. And while it's true that the same folks who brought us that other teenage girl romp, Bring It On, are enamored with flash, fancy editing, MTV, loud music, and fit teens in tight clothing, I'm not so sure that's a bad thing. Bring It On was director Jessica Bendiger's ode to cheerleaders. Stick It takes us inside the world of gymnastics. Both films deal with young women in competition. The Toro cheerleading squad from Rancho Carne High is gearing up for the national championships, and the VGA gymnasts are grinding it out in hopes of competing for the coveted and elusive spots on the USA Olympic team. Enter Haley Graham, a 17-year-old ex-gymnastics champion turned slacker, forced to re-enter the world she walked out on 2 years prior. Haley gets in trouble with the law, and her punishment? Go back to the gym. Online film reviewer Mr. Cranky likens Haley to the gymnastics version of Kelly Leak from the Bad News Bears. Quote, the seemingly bad kid with all kinds of talent who doesn't want to play the game but just needs the right kind of support network to succeed and make friends, end quote. Enter Vickerson, the hard-nosed coach with a heart of gold. All of this may sound cliche, and I can't argue that it's not, but the film was very entertaining. Reviewer Scott Tobias, writing for The Onion, calls attention to the double meaning in the title Stick It. Haley is thumbing her nose at the gymnastics establishment, but to stick it in your landing for a gymnast is a feat of real athleticism. Tobias likens the film's message to an inspiring piece of anti-inspiration a la Bull Durham or Tin Cup that considers personal integrity a greater triumph than victory. I call it a cross between finance and an officer and a gentleman. A girl with nowhere else to go sticks it to the man with a hip-hop-infused floor routine that in the end lands her squarely in the jaws of the elite. What do you think, Angela?
I like this film. It was pretty entertaining. You know, I didn't really know much about it going in. I had some very low expectations. One of the most apparent things when the film first starts is the packaging of the film, sort of the over-packaging of the film. It's very retro. These kids are super cool. They're slackers. They're hanging out in this, you know, like, development that is still in the making, and they take over these buildings they set up a whole... Remember the whole elaborate thing in the first scene where the guy is able to go down all the different... Starts at the second floor, goes out the window,
over
hops
the ladder.
The ladder is, yeah.
Into an empty
very
pool.
Very elaborate.
they're super
extreme,
cool.
Yeah, extreme
super
sports.
Cool.
Yeah. And I lost count with the concert dirts that Haley is wearing, you know, in the beginning anyway of her transformation. As this, you know, she starts out as this rebel girl. And Ramones, AC/DC, Motorhead. I mean, you know, these...
Orange Crush.
I mean, very, very cool kids. And, of course, the... the music goes right along there. What's interesting to me, and the first thing that sort of came to mind is, you know, Haley is this very natural beauty. She's, you know, stripping down her clothes. We see, you know, her running for safety shelter from the cops in the beginning, you know, before she gets her sentence. And, you know, she's got this great, perfectly faded Ramones T-shirt. I mean, she looks great, you know, every teenage boy's dream. And I think she's sort of a cross between the 70s, Ally McGraw, what was it, Love Story was her big thing, and Hilary Swank. So you have this mixture of, like, you know, old guard and the new, and I'm kind of seen as a good, you know, feminist movie of, you know, this girl who's a rebel, and Hilary Swank is the one of the icons, certainly, of this generation for these, you know, girls at these age, at this age. And Hilary Swank has really chosen some pretty body, meaty roles. So I think that's cool.
Well, yeah, and I think your point about, you know, just raising the question about a film like this being a feminist film, because we can, you know, ask those same questions about the prior film, which was Bring It On. There was Mean Girls, a recent film as well, and we get this these kinds of films that are comedies on some level, but they indulge and use the current fashions, they're very true to what it is that kids are submerged in right now, what it is that they're dealing with, what are the pressures, what are the, you know, the conflicts, the obstacles, and in some ways they do it very well. And I think, you know, while some of this real retro styling can seem over the top, it's out there. It's really what's happening. And funny for those of us who are kind of converging on middle age, it's like, you know, those bands weren't even, I mean, they weren't even alive when those bands came out. So that's a funny aspect of it.
And two, to say, I mean, you know, in the beginning we're seeing Haley and her crew. Now that is contrasted after she gets her punishment and is sent away to Vickerman's gym. I mean, these girls are, we get the world. We get the insider view of what it means to be a gymnast, to be a teenage girl, having her eye on being a part of the Olympic team. And, you know, we get a lot of sort of the work of being a real athlete. And, you know, there's lots of skin shown as well, which I know is a criticism of this film because of the age range of the girls. But to see, like, you know, these girls are tough, but yet they're real prisses, you know.
That's really the basis of this film, is that, you know, the reason why Haley is a rebel is because she's rebelling against this world that she spent a lot of her childhood in, which was a world full of convention, full of the pursuit of perfection, full of catty girls who would do anything to get the gold. And she is rejecting that. And what the film really ends up doing is kind of dealing with those kinds of things through the process of the competition. There's a point at which it becomes obvious that the judges have too much control, and the girls unite and end up rebelling against that point system. And I think that, you know, there's a sort of monologue, or, you know, narration that Haley's character gives us that kind of walks us through a little bit and provides a sense of perspective from her part. And I think the film does a great job. I mean, it's certainly not going to be a perfect feminist film, but I think it's a well-made film, and I think it's interesting, and I think it's, you know, I'd certainly rather have my 15-year-old niece watching this film than, you know, many I can think of.
Yeah. Well, the soundtrack alone definitely is worth seeing the film. But, you know, to talk about the pressure, too, that these girls are under, I mean, the scene where the national conference, they're at the national conference to compete with all these other amazing gymnasts who are trying to be a part of the world team to go to the Olympics. And, you know, Haley has this past that's sort of haunting her at this is the next conference after the last that she, you know, walked out. And, you know, the sportscasters are booming, like, you know, throughout the gym. They're showing Haley walking around with all the rest of the girls lining up and getting ready for, I think, four events make up the conference. And, you know, they're talking about her as though she's a professional athlete. You know, Haley pulled out of the last conference. We've got a situation here where there's a lack of trust and all, you know, and they're really building up the psychological trauma for the, you know, potential trauma for these girls. So, I mean, I thought the film did a great job of really respecting, kind of, and I know that that's a criticism as well, that that this film is defiling some sort of sanctimonious, you know, gymnasts, you know, and it's just, if anything, it's saying there's an art form here. I mean, you know, the floor event, I think, is the only event where the girls are able to, you know, traditionally to come up with something creative in their own thing. They get to pick the music. There certainly are rules there as well, but and the girls, you know, over one, I think it's in the prevent, that's what starts the rebellion, is I think it's the single vault. And one of the team members from Haley's team does perfectly and sticks it. She lands perfectly, and she nailed it. And the judges give her a 9.8. And, you know, Jeff Bridges, who plays Vickerman, goes insane and wants to confront a judge about it. And, like, what were the points for? You got to tell me. And finally the woman gives up and says that it's for a bra strap showing. And the crowd goes nuts. And the girls decide to, you know, to scratch the whole event. And so there's only three events left, and they decide that they're going to take the event into their own hands and choose who's going to win each event, the single vault, double vault, and I guess the floor event. And it's great. So during the whole thing, the judges don't know. It's kind of tense, you know. They see what the girls are doing, and what's going to happen is there's only going to be one girl who's going to, you know, perform. The rest of them are going to scratch.
And as they scratch, they're doing all sorts of inventive things with their bra straps, which there we can come full circle back to a kind of traditional feminist symbol, the bra.
Yeah, the bra.
So, well, Angela, we do recommend this film, and we can say, you know, parents should drop their children off to see it. yes. We're talking about Stick It. I'm Denise Morris with Angela Jones this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
My style can't be duplicated or recycled. This chick is a sick individual.
Sick Tape, Volume 2. Believe it.
Let me switch up the game. I drink that cone. Step back cause I might put it on. I go deep, so deep till your teeth count sheep. Wake you up from moaning. You don't want me at the show, yeah. How freaky back when I ain't sober. What up, I'm so up, show up. Ain't scared to take it all, tell a freak to take it all. Tipsy and I feel good. Black dudes got big
rules. Yes, hip-hop has invaded gymnastics. What's happening to our children? Comrades, I think there's hope, actually. So thanks to our movie mole. Next, the last piece on today's Old Mole, Ashley Albies. Welcome to KVU. I hope I pronounced your name right. I didn't. I
did. No, you didn't.
I should have checked on that ahead of time. Oh, good. Ashley Albies is a local attorney. She's working on, in fact, has quite a major role in the challenge to the Bush administration's wiretapping by the National Security Agency. That's the NSA. God, what are we going to do? The CIA and the FBI have been marginalized. We now have a new super spy agency. They were apparently too sort of involved in legality to really be appropriate for the Bush administration. So we are now really expanding this whole new group of super sleuths, the NSA and many others. It seems to me that though that wiretapping is sort of kind of the latest scandal, but it's just one of a long, very lengthy list of illegal and repressive activities by the Bush administration, all, of course, in the name of national security. Ashley Albies, before we get to the wiretapping stuff and all that, let's remind listeners of what the Bush administration has been doing.
Where do we start? well, first, I think, you know, the NSA program is pretty extraordinary expansion of executive power. There's also the extraordinary renditions, which occur when the United States either kidnaps suspected terrorists or in some cases, people that turn out to have no links to terrorism and sends them to foreign countries like Syria to be tortured.
Those nasty Syrians. And we send them to Syria to be tortured, though.
Basically.
They do have some use, Syria. We're also demanding that they become more democratic. Yes?
At the same time, it's interesting.
At the same time, yeah.
There's also Guantanamo, which, you know, they've blocked any kind of investigation into the actual, you know, conditions in Guantanamo, as well as Abu Ghraib. There's been very little accountability for the torture that occurred at Abu Ghraib. There's domestic surveillance. There's spying on lawful activities. The ACLU, in a recent FOIA case, uncovered information that the FBI has been surveilling peace groups and anti-war groups. There's also, you know, any leakers that leak in information, leak, you know, the program, leak the secret prisons all over the world that the CIA operates. They're challenged as being they're being called, what's the correct word? You had it nailed before, Bill.
Oh, treason. They're being charged with treason, actually, by these right-wing pundits. Yeah.
They're undermining the security of the United States and that sort of thing. And the government has an increased secrecy about everything they do. On one hand, they want more information about the activities that American citizens are engaging in, and at the same time, they're trying to cover up everything that they're doing, you know, in order to, quote, keep us safe.
Mm-hmm. In the cases that you're working on, that's apparently what they do. They don't even respond to the lawsuits. They say this is completely impermissible. These are matters of national security. The executive cannot be challenged.
Exactly.
That's apparently what they... That's their response.
Exactly. They've been invoking what's called the state secrets privilege, which is this privilege that the executive has for military matters and military secrets that would compromise national security. And they've been invoking it more and more in any kind of challenges to the actions of this administration. There was the case of Cybele Edmonds, who was a whistleblower for the FBI, and Within the FBI. And the government invoked the state secrets to say that everything that had to do with her case and everything that she was basing her whistleblowing on was a state secret, and the courts rejected her attempts to hold the administration accountable for certain
really
activities.
The courts accepted that. In fact, that's a state secret, and therefore, what did that mean for?
It means the case was dismissed.
Oh, she
was a whistleblower, and she brought an action. For, you know, she was fired.
She was a whistleblower who was fired, and then
exactly.
she brought an action to be either reinstated or
exactly.
whatever, get money damages, and her case was dismissed.
And most recently on Friday.
Why don't they go after her, though? Oh, I see. That they went after her, then they would have to do something in a court to show that she had...
They say even if there was illegal activity, the basis of this lawsuit, the very subject matter of this lawsuit is a state secret, invokes national security, and therefore it can't be tried in court. Even trying it and talking about it in court would compromise national security. And they've invoked this in various cases. On Friday, the Electronic Freedom Foundation in San Francisco has brought a class action against Verizon for participating in the NSA program.
Let's go into the NSA program.
Okay.
Then, what are they doing? What's the NSA doing?
Well, there's this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which allows the government to listen in on conversations between somebody outside of the U.S., an agent of a foreign power. They have to show that one party to the conversation is an agent of a foreign power. They have to get a warrant, and that warrant is based on probable cause from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, showing that one of the participants of that conversation, the target of the wiretapping, is an agent of a foreign power. So FISA it's different from the usual probable cause standard for purely domestic surveillance, in that you don't have to show illegal activity, only that one party to the conversation is an agent of a foreign power. So
or a foreign entity, right?
Foreign
entity, that's one of the legal.
So the NSA program operates completely outside of the the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They completely bypass any kind of warrant, probable cause.
That is, they had set up a warrant procedure
exactly
for getting these wiretaps on foreign on communications coming in, and you had to go before a court to do the wiretap. At least you can do it, but you have 72 hours then to go to the court.
In a time of war, if there's an emergency, they can institute these wiretaps and then go back retroactively and get a warrant.
And out of whatever it was, 10,000, 16,000 applications, four were rejected. But the Bush administration has decided that that's too much.
That's too much of a procedure.
They can't go to the court for that,
exactly.
Even though, of course, they easily could. What's the speculation? Why, in fact, have they set up this huge program? Well, of course, the Spicer court would not allow what they're doing.
No. There's been statements made by Gonzalez to the effect that they knew that they couldn't get this program approved under FISA, and they knew that they couldn't get the program approved by Congress if they had requested it, so they just went ahead and did it, determining by themselves that this was, in fact, a legal program,
It's a matter of national security.
Exactly. And they need the tools to deal with it. And then instead of going to Congress, which is how normally our democratic system of government works, they decided to determine by themselves what's reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, what's acceptable under separation of powers, and what sort of programs that the executive can create and enforce and within only the executive branch to determine all this stuff. And as well as the executive branch is the sole, proprietor of our civil rights and civil liberties in this context, which is a radical departure from having the judicial branch and the legislative branch have any kind of role in that process.
A very radical departure. In fact, it resembles the arguments of fascist states, right?
Right.
In the name of national security, to protect the people, you have to trust our leaders to do whatever they want to do, and you can't hold them accountable, and if you try, kill you.
Or
that's a fascist state.
They say we won't let the courts review any of these policies because we'll invoke state secrets. And they've made mistakes. The Brandon Mayfield case is a perfect example of how they've made mistakes in their overzealousness and their desire to find and root out the terrorists, and they make mistakes. And if they prevent people prevent courts from having a check on them, prevent Congress from having a check on them, who's going to rein them in?
Mayfield was saved because the Spanish FBI, the equivalent of the FBI, right, the Spanish state police, went through those alleged fingerprints that they found on this bomb-making equipment. Mayfield's from Beaverton, right, this famous case. And they found out he had nothing to do with it. It was absurd. It's just that the American authorities wanted to pin something on this guy who had converted to as a Muslim. I mean, it was preposterous. He had nothing at all to do with it. They had faked this fingerprint.
And they came out so strongly saying that we have net evidence, this guy. And they say, that sort of language is used again and again and
again. They have these big press conferences celebrating themselves, protecting the American people.
They should have... sorry, go ahead.
That was what was Mayfield's. I mean, he was sort of the... He would have... And it wasn't for the Spanish authorities doing something. And weirdly, he would be in jail now and forever,
and they would
if
have,
not executed.
Right, exactly. And we would have a big fanfare about having caught this person. Meanwhile, him proclaiming his innocence, and there's nobody to check that he's actually innocent.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. Let's talk about the NSA, this new surveillance thing. They're working on many, many fronts. But this one, it seems to me, is interesting because they're collecting all of these phone records, right?
It's separate,
the biggest database in the world.
Separate program, actually, that the story was broke last week by the USA Today, and it reported the government had acquired vast amounts of calling record data, phone numbers you dial, phone numbers of people who called you, to be used for some kind of intelligence analysis, but we don't know what. And all of this information is collected on U.S. citizens. There's no foreign agent involved in this separate program. And
it's everybody, right?
It begs the question of, if you're looking for terrorists, why are you spying on U.S. citizens? Why is it so widespread? Why are you collecting all this information on U.S. citizens?
On absolutely everybody, including, I guess, email stuff, too, which is, in fact, some of it, there's a question of whether it's even privileged at all. They're apparently going to the, whatever they are, the email carriers, and adding that to their database.
Oh, yeah, I'm I have not heard specifics. I haven't read too much on the new program.
Yeah, and that they can just read. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the phone calls.
And
really,
whenever they enter into the substance of communications, they're normally required to have a warrant. So in this case, it's a radical departure that they're not required to have a warrant. And they say that it's reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, but like I mentioned before, reasonableness is something that has historically been determined by the court, not by one single branch, not by, you know, one person in the NSA saying, this is what I think is reasonable, therefore we go ahead and invade these privacy rights.
This is KABU 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mall, talking to Ashley Albies, who's an attorney and working, in fact, on one of these electronic surveillance cases. Ashley Albies, tell us about, you know, briefly, the kind of the stuff that's been in the news on the case that you're working on.
Well, briefly, in February of 2004, our client, the Islamic charity Al Haramain, Oregon, had its assets froze by the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And in August 2004, it provided documentation to Al Haramain's lawyers at the time that were challenging the freezing of this asset and its designation as a global terrorist organization. There were documents handed over to the lawyers indicating that they had been wiretapped without a warrant, the lawyers and one of the directors of the organization. They apparently used this information in the designation, and that violates due process in the sense that you usually have, number one, they didn't get a warrant for this kind of surveillance to get this information, operated wholly outside the structures and the laws and the systems required for this type of surveillance. Normally, like I mentioned before, the FISA Surveillance Act. So they operated wholly outside of law in gaining this information and then used it against our client. And we're, at this point, we're challenging the NSA program itself in its entirety and the administration's assertion that this is an entirely legal program. It's an entirely legitimate program because it's not. It operates outside of clearly defined laws that FISA and says that it's the exclusive means by which this information is to be gathered. And they've just gone outside of that construct and have been gathering information how they want, with no checks from the from the judicial branch. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try and keep this out of the review by the courts, by most likely asserting the state secrets privilege. So they're just going to try and keep this program in the dark without any other branch commenting on the legality of the program.
You know, people have speculated, why, if they're going after terrorists, are they building up this huge database? And I read in the Wall Street Journal, who defends anything the administration does, the editorial page, they argue, that's nothing. All this is getting it's just a big pile of phone records, the same kind of phone records you get in the mail. But of course, the New York Times, who's critical of the Bush administration, to credit, maybe, they argued, look, this is all of this data together, in fact, takes every person in the United States and makes it possible for the state, for the Bush administration, to look at any person and all of their associates, and anybody that they communicate with becomes part of that record. That is, and every person, and they can see everybody's networks of everything, because they know the places they call, the people they talk to, they all have names somehow attached to them, the organizations they're part of, the calling patterns, they get the complete sort of sense of everybody. I mean, it's astounding, actually, mm-hmm. The data that they're compiling in this secret agency somewhere, far more secret now than the CIA or the FBI, who are sort of, they're secret, but they're not as black boxed as the NSA.
Right. And you have to ask, why are they compiling all this information? And, you know, their answer is that you don't need to know. This is protecting the national security. You do not need to know. Meanwhile, it's citizens that they're intruding their privacy rights. And we do have a right to know. This is our government. They're operating for, you know, based at our direction, or at least they're supposed to be based on our direction. And they're operating wholly outside of the laws that are passed by our elected leaders.
We only have another few seconds, Ashley Albies. What can people do? get involved in various organizations, support the National Lawyers Guild.
Support the National Lawyers Guild. Write letters to the editor. The Oregonian has intervened in our case, so it's important to keep the dialogue open and maintain solidarity with all these groups that are being spied on. We need to look past our ideological differences and operate in solidarity. They're collecting data on millions of Americans, and spying on anyone is an affront to everyone. And we need to join together and make sure that they don't erode our privacy rights to the point that they're non-existent.
And look at websites. There's a whole series of them, right? Which ones do you think is best for?
The NLG has a great website.
The National Lawyers Guild,
the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org.
Electronic Privacy.
Electronic Freedom Foundation, EFF.org. And another point also is that call your senators. General Hayden, who is one of the architects of this NSA program, is being considered for director of the CIA. So, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to call your senators and during his confirmation hearings, we want answers as to this program.
Right. Ashley Albies, thank you. Thanks for talking with us. Thanks for all the people on today's Old Mole. Stay tuned for the food show, then Democracy Now! Thanks to our underwriter, Cotton Cloud Funtan. Thanks to Tyson Slocum of the Critical Mass Energy Project, to Clayton Morgridge, today's Movie Moles, Denise Morris and Angela Jones. And, of course, thank you again, Ashley Albies, local lawyer and National Lawyers Guild. Stalwart.
Okay, that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour today. Coming right up, it's the food show. Don't forget that at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, top officials from two of Sudan's main rebel groups and journalist Tina Sussman of Newsday discuss the situation in Darfur and the new peace agreement. And journalist and author Greg Palast discusses his new book, Armed Madhouse. Right now, we're going to go to the food show, which today features a live interview with journalist and writer Eric Schlosser. He's got a new book. You'll want to stay tuned for that.